story. Everybody knows it. It's in every Sunday school. It's somewhere in all the stories of the Bible. The thing we sometimes forget, especially being a modern, civilized, advanced society with technology, that this is a true story. This was a real situation. It's not some kind of Jewish fable. The story of David and Goliath recounts a historical situation that occurred in Israel's history where God intervened with the people through a man named David. Now, the thing I put on the top of this is kind of interesting, and I think it's something we need to consider, is nothing to prove, nothing to lose. And that's not the title of the sermon, I guess, but you want to title it, you can. David is going to approach this as he's not trying to prove something. He's not trying to become the king of Israel. He's not trying to be the hero. He's not trying to impress King Saul. He's not trying to live up to his father's and his brother's expectations. David is simply doing one thing. Some would want to teach this possibly, and again, I suppose you could. What are the 5 steps to slaying a giant? What are the 6 things you need to know to be a godly hero? That's probably appropriate. You could probably find, you know, different steps in there. But it comes down to this one thing, I think, and that is the fear of God. That David honored God in his life. David feared God when he was with the sheep. David knew God was watching him wherever he was in his life. And the way he handled his job as a shepherd is the way he's going to handle the rest of his life. It's not like he's going to try to now prepare for the battle. Okay, now I've got a call of God. I've got a responsibility. I've got to go out here and face a giant. Okay, so I better get focused. I've seen this before. I remember being on team one time. We had a basketball team, and I was playing, and we went through the whole season playing a 2-1-2 zone. You know, big guys, hands up like this, and we won a lot of games, won all our games. Yeah, we did. And going into the tournaments, and I remember the coach saying something like this. It's like, okay, if we're going to do well in the tournaments, we've got to learn how to play man-to-man. And, you know, I was just, but it's kind of like, you look back, it's kind of like, we played the whole season in a zone. And now, quick, tonight I'm going to teach you how to play man-to-man so we're ready for the state tournament or for the sectional tournaments. You can't do that. You can't live your Christian life that way. I'm just a normal person going through my life, but someday when God calls, when there's a real giant I've got to face, then I'm going to learn to be a man of faith. Then I'm going to learn to do what God called me to do. Now, David has been doing what was right with the sheep. And if he succeeds in killing the giant or if he doesn't, he knows what is right. And David is not looking at this as a chance to promote himself. He's simply looking at this as there's a giant defying the armies of the living God. I have to engage in this. Why, David? Why are you? Do you think this is a step up the scale of the hierarchy of Israel? Or no, I don't. Someone's got to do it. I'll do it. Now, that's the same way he approached the bear, the same way he approached the lion that attacked the sheep. He's going to do the same thing here. And here's what it is. He has nothing to prove. He has nothing to lose. And I know we've all lived and gone through things in our life, but the minute you start worrying about trying to prove something, or the minute you start trying to protect something that you could possibly lose, it's over. Because now what are you fearing? You're fearing loss, you're fearing people, you're fearing the circumstances where David has nothing to prove to God and he has nothing to lose as long as he does what is right. The heroes in the Bible, even Paul, the apostle, approached his ministry, approached life as if I live or if I die, I'm going to do the right thing. Job says, though he slay me, yet will I serve him. David is going at this knowing what God's plan is, but I don't think David would have stepped back and said, well, you know, it may not work out. Well, then I'm not going to do what's right. I mean, okay, we can come back to the church, where we're at right now. Things are looking good. We're doing some great things. God is moving in our midst. God, we don't want to mess this up. It's over. Once you say, man, I hope we don't mess this up. Well, if you're fearing God, if you're trying to do what is right, if you're living a life and trying to do what God has called you to do, just keep doing it. People may come, people may go. It's like Bible teaching. It's like, you understand, I'm going through 1 Samuel. Yeah, chapter by chapter, verse by verse. That's like, oh God, what if people don't like that? I don't care. You know, it's like, yeah, you see? But it's like, but what happens if they like that sermon? They don't like the next sermon. That's not my issue. And again, I don't care is maybe a negative way of saying it, but it's like we have nothing to prove. We have nothing to lose. We're teaching the Bible. Or in my case, I'm teaching the Bible. The same thing, whatever God's called the church to do, whatever God has called you to do, do it. If everybody leaves, they leave. It's like a relaxed mental attitude. I know what I'm going to do. And again, that doesn't mean you don't listen to advice, you don't do what's smart. David is going to do a lot of things in here. But listen, his motivation for doing everything that he's doing in this chapter or has done up to this chapter is because he's feared God. He is able to sling a stone because he's been diligent in practicing to protect the sheep. You understand? It's not a matter of, Joel, I'm just going to sit down and just let God do what he wants to do. No, you've got to prepare, but your motivation for preparing is that you fear God. Fear God in both the negative and the positive sense. God is able to deliver and advance. God is able to destroy and remove. It says he lifts kings up, he takes kings down. It's the same God. He does the same thing with churches. He does the same with ministries. He does the same with our lives. As we follow God, he'll use us. So our fear is not, I don't know, what do people think? What are we going to do? What if we mess this up? If you're doing what God's called you to do, he is the author of what's going on. He is the author of advance. He's the author of removal. And removal does not always mean failure. I'll say it again. Removal does not always mean failure. John the Baptist summed it up the best. When Jesus had been anointed or baptized, had gone into the wilderness, had come back, and it says more people began to follow Jesus than John the Baptist. And they came to John. They says, look, everybody that was following you is going over to follow Jesus. They've joined the new church. What about your church? He says, I told you from the beginning, a man can only receive what the Lord has given him. I'm going to decrease, he's going to increase. So does that mean John failed? Does that mean John didn't keep up with the times? It means John had done his ministry, he'd performed what God had wanted him to do, and God has gone, nice job, thanks John, you may sit down, and we're going on. I mean, that's the body of Christ. So even to lose, as far as falling backwards or not growing or gaining, doesn't mean anything. You must follow God. You must fear God. David has feared God from watching the sheep all the way up into our story today. And that is why we're going to read this chapter eventually. We're going to read this chapter, and you're going to see some things taking place here. It's like just contrast of attitude. And David is like looking at him going, what are you thinking? But likewise, they're looking at David going, you're crazy. What are you thinking? It's got people who are fearful of men and looking at the circumstances, and David, who is fearful of God and looking at the promises. And you're going to get two completely different reactions. And when the two meet, they don't understand each other. In fact, David's brothers are going to end up accusing him of all kinds of evil and wicked plans and motivation. And David's going, what? Because a man of faith, a man who's doing what God has called him to do, living righteously to the world or people that are not living by faith, they can only assign to that person of faith their wrong attitudes. The reason why is that person doing that? Must be a wrong motive, because that's the only thing they can come up with. So let's look very quickly here. You've got some notes, and let's read chapter. You might want to turn to the very last page of the notes first. It's titled David and Goliath, but it's a map. It's a map of kind of the first three verses here. Because again, I want to emphasize, this is a historical story. This actually happened. It is not mythology. There is mythology, but this is not it. This is a true story. And this, what we see here, the character of David, the character of God, the character of the Israelites, the character of the enemy, is the way it is throughout the Bible, throughout time, even in our own day, even in the future days of the earth. These are the same character traits we're going to see throughout that time. So listen very carefully, chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah in Judah. And there you've got Socah right there. It's 15 miles west of Bethlehem. It's about 7 miles from the city of Gath, which is a Philistine city. So you can see the dots right there. That's the cities. And over in Gath is the Philistine territory. Then going over by Socah, that is the Israelite or the territory of Judah. And the Philistines have advanced into the land of Israel. Remember this earlier? Before Samuel became the judge and began helping the people, ruling, leading the people, the Philistines had overrun the land. They're back in the land again during the days of King Saul. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Socah and Azekah. And you can see Azekah is another city. And Ephes Damim, right there, would be, there's a valley. We're going to read about the valley here in the next part of this verse. There's a valley between Socah and Azekah, those two cities. And the valley runs kind of like an S, but basically right at this point right here, it's running east and west right through that area. And over on the west bank of the valley, in Ephes Damim, is where the Philistines have set up camp. And their entire army is there. Their troops are there. They're ready for war. And then it goes on and says, verse 2, Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the Valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. And Valley of Elah would be on the other side towards Succoth. And so what you basically have is a valley, and it's not just a, you know, a dip down. You know, it's going to be like a little of a plain. And on the two sides of the hills coming down, the Philistines are on one side and will come down into the valley to engage in battle. The Israelites will come down and engage in battle right here in the valley there. This place still exists. You can still go here. In fact, they take bus tours out there. I've talked to people that have gone there. In fact, one individual says, you know, they pull the bus up and everybody goes down to that little, there's a little creek running through the valley yet today. And in that creek, you know, everybody goes down, they look, and it's like, sure enough, you know what's still in that creek? Stones. Just like the stones that David picked up. Remember, he's going to pick up 5 smooth stones out of that creek. And they go down there, and people, you know what they do? You know what you're going to do? They're going to take one. They put it in their pocket. And this guy came back up to the bus, and the bus driver was sitting there. He goes, can they just take stones like that? He goes, oh, yeah, it's not a problem. So we bring stones in every couple of weeks, bring a couple of loads in. So there is a real place there, but the stones, you know, people have been taking the stones for, you know, 2,000 years. They're like, we better bring some more stones in for the tourists. But anyway, you can still see this place. It's still there. It says, the Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with the valley in between. So you got the story here. You got the picture. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. Now, we might as well turn back to the first page. You've got the map right there. On the notes there, I typed it up very quickly. He's got Goliath as being, if you notice right there, 9 inches and 9 inches tall. Ben pointed that out to me just before I came up. You're just a little boost of confidence. Hey, Dad, look at this. Thanks, Ben. So that's supposed to be 9 feet. 9 inches tall, and that was the, as you break that measurement down. Some people say, well, that can't be true. See, it's just a story about a giant that never really existed. The issue with here is that this is true, because one, it's in the scriptures. Second, I don't know why this stuff doesn't make it in the newspapers. Well, I know why it doesn't make it in the newspapers. They have discovered, and again, I'd heard this before, but I found some very reliable sources that record, and they've got this right here. They have found large scale, over 10-foot tall skeletons in the land of Philistia, in this area right here over on the west side of west of Judah. They've discovered them. They're there. You read Josephus, the Jewish historian who wrote around 70 to 90 AD. I've got his book. You can get his book. It's online. In there, he recounts and records that you could still see these skeletons in his day, that they are in cases, that you could go see these huge skeletons. He says they were terrifying. That's 70 AD, a Jewish historian. Not trying to convince you of anything, but just saying that this is a fact. He's got a huge volume. He just writes a variety of different things and records in different accounts of these skeletons, of these huge giants still being intact and still being around. So this is not a stretch. In fact, we could go through the Bible accounts, and because of time, I'm not going to, but I will refer to these. In Joshua's day, when Joshua came into the promised land, there were giants in the land. You remember the story of the spies that went, and they came back, the 12 spies came back and told people, there's giants there, we can't take this land. So all the people got afraid, and they wouldn't go, similar to our story today. Those giants, 40 years later, when Joshua and Caleb finally came into the land of Israel, those giants were still there. They're in the hill country of Judea, the book of Judges, or book of Joshua records. But Caleb, along with Joshua, it says they drove them out of the hill country of Judea and drove them west, drove them over to the Mediterranean Sea, which is now the land of Philistia in our story today. So in Joshua's day, a few hundred years before, the giants had been driven over to the land, over to the Mediterranean coast, over the land of Philistia. And that is where Goliath comes from. Now, before that time, before they entered the land, before they saw it, we have a record of them being back in Abraham's day, of the eastern kings coming down and fighting the kings. And then this time, they extended across over on the east side of the Jordan and down south of the Dead Sea. They were fighting them at that time. So these giants were in the book of Joshua. They're in the book of Genesis. In Deuteronomy, it records the king of Og, King Og of Bashan. He was buried in a coffin that was over 13 feet long, it records there, and records fighting many of the giants. It goes even further back into Genesis chapter 6 potentially. Now, this is where we get off on theology and different interpretations, but it's the only clear, correct interpretation, I think, as you read through it. You got to do some religious monkey work trying to make it feel normal for us. But the text says in Genesis chapter 6 that at that time the Nephilim, the fallen ones, came and they produced among men let's just read it very quickly. I said we weren't going to do this, but let's go, because right now you're looking at me like, what is he talking about? Those other references just refer to very large people, giants in the land. But in Genesis chapter 6, let me just read. This is before the flood of Noah. It says, when men began to increase in number, Genesis chapter 6, verse 1, when men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. Now the verse 4 says, the Nephilim. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and our important verse here tonight, or this morning, is, were in those days, and also afterwards, where the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They're the heroes of old, the men of renown. So right here it counts a story of the sons of God coming to the daughters of men and producing children. Now, whatever you want to do with that verse, you can. If you want to say, well, this sounds like fiction, I don't think I can accept this, very good. Well, probably the rapture sounds like fiction. Probably the millennium where Jesus Christ returns to the planet sounds like fiction. Probably that God became a man who was born of a virgin and died on the cross for the sins of the whole world sounds like a fable to you also. This is a supernatural world. We see such a physical world that all we think about is the natural things and what we see and what we can control. We forget that there's another group outside called the angelic spiritual beings, and we also forget that there's a God who's beyond everything that we can see or understand or touch. There's another whole dimension out here. In fact, we are spiritual beings living in a physical body in a physical world. We are going to live forever, not here, but in another place, in another dimension. So I am not concerned with people saying, well, I don't know, that sounds kind of strange. The whole story sounds kind of strange if you're an atheist, if you're a secular humanist, and all you think is what you see is what you get. The whole story sounds kind of strange. This is saying that the sons of God came to the daughters of men. You got three basic interpretations of that. One, the sons of God would be the royal children of the pharaohs, went to the common girls and they had children. Okay, that's fine. The other thing, the sons of God, could refer to the kings themselves having harems. And they had all these women in their harems and they produced these heroes of old. I guess it's similar to that same one. Or the sons of God can refer to the righteous children, you know, the good Sunday school boys who went to church all the time. They saw the daughters of men, which were the wicked girls, you know, they chewed tobacco and smoked and used bad profanity. And then these Sunday school boys, the sons of God, saw that these girls were really beautiful with their tobacco and all, and they married them. And then they had these children called the heroes of old. So in one case, you've got the pharaohs and the royalty having harems and common girls producing these heroes of old. The other is you've got the good boys of Seth's line having children through Cain's line, the bad girls, producing the heroes of old. Or you've got the typical interpretation of this Hebrew phrase, sons of God, which is translated even in the book of Job chapter 1, the angels. The sons of God came to the earth and had children through the natural women, the super race of people. And it says right here in verse 4, it says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. The Nephilim means the fallen ones were on the earth in those days and also afterward, meaning before the flood and also after the flood. When the sons of God, either the good Sunday school boys, the pharaohs and their sons, or angelic creatures, went to the daughters of men and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. Heroes of old means superhumans, and men of renown, it means the men on whom legends were written about, which we get probably Greek mythology from these times. Throughout the ancient history, it talks about the battles between men and the gods that had invaded the planet. It's throughout the ancient world. But nonetheless, it talks about this right here. This continues. This would have continued. They would have been wiped out in the flood, but would have come back again, and Satan would have tried it again. His reason, why would this have happened? Because in the Garden of Eden, it was promised the seed of the woman will crush the serpent's head. In other words, this human race, someone is going to emerge from this human race that is going to crush Satan's kingdom, is going to defeat it in the sense of crushing his head, eliminate his power, the seed of the woman. Satan's strategy, will corrupt the seed of the woman. Just like his strategy today is to corrupt any kind of family, any kind of morality, anything that could produce righteous, godly children of family value, of righteous value, that could upset his kingdom. In this case, he's going to corrupt the woman's seed. So there are no, in a sense, pure humans on the earth. And God stopped it in that day with the flood, along with other wickedness on the earth. And afterwards, he would have tried it again. It says, and after this. Those giants are recorded in Genesis 14. They're recorded in Exodus and Numbers. They're recorded in Deuteronomy. They're recorded in Joshua. They're recorded now all the way up to the book of 1 Samuel. 1000 BC, there are still giants on the earth. In fact, we can find in the writings there are five of them left. Goliath and four brothers, as we read into 2 Samuel and we read into 1 Chronicles, it records four other giants being killed. After that, you never hear of them again. You never hear of them again up to this point. But they were still surviving, and God now is using Israel to wipe them out and establish his kingdom of righteousness. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 17. So when I read here, it says a champion named Goliath, who was over 9 feet tall, almost 10 feet tall. The word champion means the one who stands between the two armies. The Greeks had a form of battle at this time that had come over to the Philistines, because the Philistines are, their descendants are the Greeks. The Philistines appear to have landed in the land of Philistia in some kind of Egyptian invasion where they had a shipwreck and a storm. They all just ended up there on the coast of Philistia. They stayed there. They brought their iron with them that they had invented or had discovered iron, brought that with them and began to subdue that part of the Middle East. Because at this time, the Israelites do not have iron. You're going to hear them talk about bronze and iron. Iron was like the latest technology in warfare at this time. And the Philistines had it, the Israelites didn't, and the Philistines wouldn't let them get it. They wouldn't let them have their technology. A little lesson there for protecting your own empire. The champion named Goliath. Goliath, the champion, means the man who stands between the two armies, because the Greeks had a style of warfare. They would have one champion come down from one military site and the other come down from the other side, and the two would engage in battle. That they would watch, and they'd watch the two champions fight. Goliath was the Philistines' champion. And the Philistines want the Israelites to play the same way. You send us your champion, we'll send you our champion. Our champion happens to be 10 foot tall. Who do you got? Who's your tallest guy? You know who the Israelites' tallest guy is, right? King Saul. King Saul, at this very moment, is Israel's champion. Oh, no. Israel is not in very good shape. Israel's champion is a coward. He's out of God's will. He's tormented by evil spirits, and he doesn't want to come out of his tent. You're not going to see him standing on the side of the hill. When we find Saul, you know where he's at? In his tent. Yeah, that's a good place to hide when the Philistines are invading, a tent. That's going to do you a lot of good. But that's where Saul is, commanding, of course, the military from his tent. And basically, for 40 days, we're going to see Goliath has been shouting for them to send Saul down to engage him in battle. And they don't know what to do. So goes the king, so goes the people. He goes on and describes Goliath. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. That's 125 pounds. A coat of scale armor, that would be small little brass or pieces, like almost like scales of fish is what it was. Hundreds of them all sewn together so he could move, but it would reflect any kind of an arrow or something that he would wear. 125-pound coat, 125-pound armor that he had on. On his legs he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. This is one of the greatest descriptions of any particular character in the entire Bible right here, the most detail. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod. That means the spear shaft that he was carrying was very long. It was several feet long, 8 or 9 feet long. And this is important right here. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and it's, here it is, iron point weighed 600 shekels. That's 15 pounds. In other words, it weighed as much as a shot put. He had this long shaft with a shot put on the end. Of course, it wasn't like a shot put. It'd be almost like flames coming off like a spear point. But that's what he was throwing. Now, can you imagine this man throwing this spear, the momentum that was behind that thing when it would strike, you know, a front line? I mean, it'd go through several rows of people. The thing was, it was a war machine is what he was. And he's coming down. It says, his shield bearer went ahead of him. So in front of him, he had another man this guy would have to carry this huge shield that would protect Goliath as he could fight from behind this little wall that this armor bearer was carrying in front of him. And Goliath had come down and is in that condition. And when Israel saw him, now listen, This paints an insurmountable picture, and it is insurmountable for man. When man looks at this, there's nothing he can do. Only he can do is be terrorized and discouraged and say, there's nothing we can do. There's no strategy for this. This is a very good picture. I mean, especially when you can see his satanic descent or ancestry. This is a very good picture of our battle today, of we, mere people, are at war representing the kingdom of God against the kingdom of Satan, the kingdom of darkness. When I say at war, I'm not talking about, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, we're not talking about at war with flesh and blood. We're not at war with people. There's a battle going on behind the scenes here that is beyond our control, that is beyond our understanding, that is beyond our ability to inflict any kind of injury or win any kind of a battle. And Israel is standing here like mere men looking at this incredible war machine of angelic descent saying, we can't fight this. Of course you can't. David is going to show up here in a little bit, and he is going to see that also. But David is looking above and beyond that. He has the promises of God. He knows who he is as a member of Israel, just like we should know who we are as members of the body of Christ. We cannot fight the kingdoms of darkness. We have no idea what their strategy is, even hardly. But we do know Jesus Christ, we do have the Spirit of God, we do have the promise of the Word of God, and so we can follow the direction, stay in step, and win the battle, not because of who we are, but because of what God has said, what God is doing. It's not insurmountable. In fact, we are invincible in that case. And here we continue. It says, verse 8, Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we'll become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you'll become our subjects and serve us. Then the Philistine said, now that was the challenge, and now this right here is the insult. That was the strategy. Here's our plan. You fight me, I'll fight you. If we win, you become our servants. If I win, or however, there was the opposite of that one. Okay? I'd moved on to the next subject already. All of a sudden my mind, blank line. Now here's that was the plan. That was the battle or the game arrangement. Verse 10. Then the Philistine said, this day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other. Now notice what he says. This day I defy the ranks of Israel. And that is what the Israelites heard. They heard him defying them personally. They heard that man defying them as men. He says, I defy the ranks of Israel. He has no recognition of their God. He is not saying, I defy your God. So Israel forgot about their God. They do not see themselves as connected with their God. We sometimes forget that we are servants of Jesus Christ. If you don't live like a servant of Jesus Christ, if you don't think like a servant of Jesus Christ, if you don't go through your daily life knowing that everything I'm doing is in service to Jesus Christ, when something attacks you, when something comes against you, you're going to take it as a personal insult. And then it's man versus man, and there you go. You're never going to get anywhere. But when you live your life for Jesus Christ, when you consider the ministry that you have, whatever God has called you to do, as being for Jesus Christ, then when someone tries to stop it, or someone tries to slow it down, or Satan attacks, or discouragement sets in, you realize also, this is what God has called me to. I'm not trying to prove something. I'm not afraid of losing something. I've got nothing to lose. Anything I've got has been given to me by God, and when God's done, He's going to take it from me. So here we go. Let's engage in battle. And when it's over, it's over. But if you begin to think like a man, like you're trying to keep everything for yourself and achieve everything by yourself, then all of a sudden, you pressure's on. You start to feel the pressure. And once pressure sets in, you start to, your train of thought loses, and I lose that all the time. You can't think straight, train of thought, there it goes. When that sets in, then all of a sudden, you cannot reason logically, your priorities change, and you start making decisions that are no longer godly, but based on your own assumptions. So let's go with this again. He says, this day, I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other. On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul
and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now, the word dismayed means this, if you don't mind. It means to break down by violence or confusion. It means to abolish, to be afraid, to beat down, to discourage. Basically, today it means to crack under the stress, to crack under pressure. So when it says, when they heard this, they cracked under the pressure and they could no longer think clearly. They were discouraged. Now, how come? Because they've been basing everything on themselves. King Saul has based his entire kingship on what he wanted to do. When David hears the same thing, he is not going to be encouraged. He's going to be motivated because he hears this as an attack against the promises of God and sees beyond the screen of man's threats. The next word, terrified, means simply to be afraid. It can mean fear or it can mean reverence. In a positive sense, it means reverence towards God. In a negative sense, it means to be afraid of something so that you're immobile. And so these men, when they hear Goliath, they have more reverence for Goliath than they do for God. And so when he threatens to kill them, they're afraid, instead of having reverence of God who says, I will protect you. And that's there it is right here. That's bottom line right there. That is why David is successful. You can find your steps. How did David do this? What should we do to be like David? Well, right here. When they heard the threats of Goliath, they had reverence for Goliath, and they feared his threats. And they thought, we don't know what we're going to do. David had reverence for God, and when he heard Goliath's threats, he just remembered God's promises, had reverence for God, not worried. He's not afraid of Goliath. He's afraid of God. And so when we are fearful of God, when we reverence God, these things right here, of course they're going to be pressure. Of course, that's what it talks about in Romans, to renew your mind. Of course you're going to have moments of falling back. But this is our target. We want to think like David thinks. Now David, he introduces David, was a son of Ephrathite named Jesse. Ephrathah was the old name of the city of Bethlehem where David is from. And so it's got, this is why even in the prophecies it talks about Bethlehem of Ephrathah. It used to be the old name. There's another Bethlehem up in the tribe of Zebulun up north. So there's two Bethlehems and they kept them straight by saying Bethlehem of Ephrathah. Jesse is an Ephrathite, meaning his heritage goes way back to the old days of Bethlehem. As we know, he was one of the descendants of one of the two spies that Joshua sent across the Jordan, him and Rahab. Jesse had eight sons, and in Saul's time, he was old and well advanced in years. That's Jesse. Jesse's three oldest sons followed Saul into war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The three oldest followed Saul. It's the third time in the Hebrew it says they followed Saul. They followed Saul. In other words, they walked after Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. We know from the previous chapter, David had been asked to come and play the harp and sing to relieve Saul of any kind of a stress. But David went back and forth, went to the sheep. In fact, on this day right here, he's coming from the sheep. They've gone to war. David's no longer needed in the palace, so he goes back to the sheep. So here we got him coming from the sheep. Verse 16, for 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. That means they have heard this threat 80 times. 80 times they've had a chance to decide, what are we going to do? Well, after 80 times, the pattern is set. I'm not sure why the Philistines were just waiting. They're just mocking Israel. 80 times, 40 days in a row, they come out, they ridicule Israel, they mock them. King Saul goes, I don't know what we're going to do. And everybody runs back to their tent and hides. In any case, they draw their battle lines, he mocks them, they all go running back. I don't know why the Philistines just didn't invade and wipe them out. Verse 17, now Jesse said to his son David, take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread and for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance or some token or some spoils of war from them. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. You can just see here, here's Jesse's excitement. Hey, go check on the boys. They're with Saul. They're engaged in battle with the Philistines. They need some refreshments, so you got to take the provisions. And at that time, they'd have to provide for their own family in warfare. They didn't have, you know, taxation where they, you know, had government shipping it over to them. They had to bring their own supplies, and family members had to bring it to them. Also, some extra things just for the commander. I want to keep my boys on the good side of the commander. Bring him some of these cakes right here. So he's going to take some supplies. Second, I want a report. I want a report on how they are. The word root word is from shalom, their well-being. I need their well-being. How are they? And third,
I mean, I know they're destroying the Philistines back, just like when Sammy was here, man. We're probably just busting them up. So bring back some spoils of war, something, some token of that. We're driving them back out of the land. Jesse's excited about his boys being in battle. He knows the promises of God. He knows all the great things that God is doing with Israel. He's from the tribe of Judah. This is where the Messiah is going to come from. They've got the stories that have been handed down. David learned it from somewhere. Jesse knows it. He knows the promises. So bring me back the spoils of war. So David is going to go, and he's going to do those first two things very easily. He's going to bring the supplies and go say shalom to his brothers. How's your well-being? I need a report for Dad. But one thing he's going to be missing, sorely missing, he can tell right away, there's no spoils of war. We have nothing. There's nothing. That we haven't engaged in battle yet. What's going on, guys? Well, we're going to read this. Here we go. Early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd. Again, you cannot emphasize that enough. David is a shepherd of the sheep. He's in the pasture. He's not some favored child. He's doing what is right. He's at the right place. And in that place, no matter how low it is on the totem pole, he's executing it the correct way. He is not going to have to make some kind of leap of faith when he sees Goliath. He knows how to be faithful. He knows how to trust God. He knows how to execute his job as a shepherd. So when he sees the giant, he just stays in that same mode, thinks the same way, trusts God the same way, and continues to do the right thing. The giant is no different than we're going to see the bear or the lion was. There's no difference. He doesn't make a switch. He has one game plan: fear God and do what's right. And then let the chips fall where they're. There's nothing to prove. There's nothing to lose. And when we think that way, I think that is one of the keys to success, especially when it says in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of success, the fear of the Lord. Some people want to find the step. What are the 10 steps that David did? Now watch, you can find 12 steps. You can find 35 steps. You can find 18 great points about David. But if you do not fear God, they're useless. Yeah, we can go through and find all the different. He was trained, he continued to be diligent, he didn't give up, he kept all these things. But if there's no fear of God, your 10 steps are nothing more than human effort in an organized fashion. Saul's got organized fashion, they're all hiding. They miss one thing, the fear of God. Early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd. Again, there's a responsibility. Loaded up, then set out as Jesse has directed. Now he's being obedient. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions. Timing. He's at the right place at the right time. God's leading him. Shouting the war cry. This is funny. This is really, really funny. It's been 40 days. And listen, the cheerleaders are getting tired. Listen, you've seen schools go 0-20, you know, 0-25. And their cheerleaders are like, yo, it don't matter. These guys are 0-40. They've had 80 contests. And now it's morning, you know, oh, let's go to battle. It's like, no one believes they're going to battle. And here's their war cry. Listen right here. Right, it says right here. It says, where is it at? Oh, there it is. He reached the camp as the army was going to its battle positions, shouting their war cry. That's funny. I think that's how loud were they shouting? They know Goliath's going to come out and shout them down. It happened 40 days in a row, 80 different times. The cheerleaders are, they're strung out. They're not excited at all. They're not even showing up. Go get them, guys. Yay, you know. Put little posters up. It's not going to matter. We're going to get beat. there's no enthusiasm. There can't be. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of the supplies and ran to the battle lines and greeted his brother. There he goes right there. There's someone that's in charge of the supplies. He runs in, drops them off. Brothers are going to battle. Oh, man, perfect timing. It's game time. The buzzer's going to sound. The jump ball. Here we're going. It's game time. I got a front row seat. Leaves the stuff, runs over to his brothers, runs right to the battle line and greets them. The word shalom. How's your well-being? Got three things he's got to do. Get the supplies. He's done that right away. Runs to his brother. Shalom. What's your condition? Got to tell Dad. And now, a spoil from the war. Yeah. He's going to bring something home for Dad. Okay. That's the end of the enthusiasm. It says, David left the things with the keeper of the supplies, ran to the battle lines and greeted his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from the lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. So they're all doing, you know, their cheer, whatever their Israelite cheer is to defeat the Philistines. And as they're doing a little cheer, and David's probably, oh, yeah, louder, yeah, all this, all right. And yeah, you like that, Joel. And Oh, they get shouted. Here's Goliath, louder than the whole army. He starts shouting. David turns around. It's like, whoa, come on, guys, louder, louder. And Goliath is shouting them down. And they're losing the battle of cheering. Shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. When the Israelites saw the man, oh, look at this. They all ran from him in great fear. The battle line broke. I mean, he's not shooting an arrow. He's not throwing a stone. He's shouting, boo. And the line breaks, and they all go running back. They practice this for 80 times. They know he's lined up, ready. He goes, go, go, run, run, run before he shoots one of us. And David's like, what was that? David has no understanding. He's completely dismayed. What is going on here? Now, the Israelites had been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel. So as they were talking right there, David heard the men comparing. He's been talking about this. Saul. Well, now, where's Saul? Back in the tent. He's got to make sure he's watching the battle map. You know, I want to make sure we know where the troops are. I don't want him not have good leadership. I'll stay in the tent. But he also says, I will give a great wealth, give my daughter, and exempt them from taxes. In other words, any kind of public service, you're free. You're now become taken care of by the government, the government of Saul, which is very similar to in the Greek world when an athlete would win at the Olympics or something. They'd be the fastest runner, the shot put thrower, whatever. They would come in. They'd be treated at royal or community expense for the rest of their lives for having put their city on the map in Greece or Macedonia. Well, similar thing right here. But notice what they say. The Israelites had been saying, this is where you get it, you catch it right here. The Israelites had been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. They say, this man, and they're afraid of men, he defies Israel. He's insulting us. This man is defying us men. Now David is going to hear something completely different. But they've been talking about all these benefits. Verse 26, David hears about this, all the benefits that come out. This is interesting. David asked the men standing him, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? He says, whoa, 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 tell me again. I mean, all you do is kill that guy, and you get wealth, you get the king's daughter, and you're exempt from taxes? Oh, which one of you guys are going to do that? Hey, yeah. None of them are going to deny. I ain't going to die for that. Die? We're talking about die. I'm talking about killing him. So he's picking up this, hey, this is a great deal. What am I going to risk my life for? But notice what he says right here. He doesn't call him this man. He calls him, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Now, that is not an insult. Well, it is an insult. But his point is not to insult the Philistines. He's saying uncircumcised, circumcision is a sign of the covenant with Abraham and God. It's a sign that you are the people of God and God has given you promises. For example, this is your land. I will come against anyone who comes against you. I'll come against them. And so the Israelite was circumcised as a sign of that covenant with God. And now here's a Philistine who is insulting them saying, I'm going to come and destroy you. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that we should, that he should not defy Israel, but notice, defy the armies of the living God. David sees Israel as being God's army. The Israelites saw themselves being insulted by a man. David sees an uncircumcised Philistine without a covenant from God insulting the armies of God. We're his people. He says, why is this going on? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Well, look how tall he is. Look how strong he is. Look at his armor. That spear's got a 15-pound spearhead on it, David. Yeah, but he's not got a covenant with God, and he's insulting God's army. Guys, come on. He doesn't stand a chance. Notice the difference. One man has got faith in the promises of God. He believes God is real and is moving in history at his time. Listen, you need to believe that God is moving right now in history. He didn't used to move in the church age back in the beginning. He didn't used to move in the Old Testament. Someday he'll move again. God is moving right now in history. He always is moving. And when you connect yourself historically with God in your lifetime, then all of a sudden the Bible comes to life. And when God says, go into all the world and preach the gospel, it's like, yeah, somebody should probably do that sometime. No, that means like today, go. It's open. The promise God is, God told in the book of Revelation, those first chapters, he told one of the churches, see, Philadelphia, the sixth church, he says, see, I've set before you an open door that no one can close, and no one's going to stop you. Just go through. That is a promise of God. God has given us certain commissions, certain commands. He's told us in the local body that every person has a gift. Every person has a gift for the common good of everyone. Well, maybe somewhere. No. Historically, right now today, if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, then you have the Spirit of God living in you. You've been empowered. You've been equipped to help other people, to encourage other people, and to make a difference, just like David is going to make a historical difference in his society because he simply did what God told him to do. He feared God. And when we fear God in our history right now today, we will change history. It's promise. It's the way it is. When we separate ourselves from the Bible and separate ourselves from the history that God is doing right now, we become isolated islands just kind of watching, you know, like fans at a ball game, just watching, hoping someone scores, someone does something. When we realize all of us are participants right now. David is one of an entire army that's going to respond. Just imagine if a group of people responded instead of just one. Just think if the entire army, now watch, if the entire army thought the way David thought, what would happen to the Philistines? It wouldn't be David killing one giant at a time. It would be it'd be great. And we're going to read later on in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel that David is slowly going to take his faith and begin to bring people towards him and engage with him in battle. And we're going to end up, by the time we get done, we're going to have a chapter that's going to list David's mighty men, the men who did great exploits, men that fought and killed the other four giants, men that are going to do things that David did. The thing is, it was unique in David's day right here because no one was doing it. By the time David gets done being king, common occurrence, headlines every day, another hero, another great episode in the military. David is going to spread this. This is unique, but it doesn't have to be. Do you understand? The heroes of the Bible are unique because everybody else around them was cowards. If everybody would respond, what would happen is you'd have, just like God says, a kingdom of priests and kings doing what God has called them to do. A priest stands between God and people. A priest takes God's message or God's blessing and brings it to the people and represents the people before God. The church is called a kingdom of priests. We are priests of our own soul, but we're also priests representing God to the entire world. And if God has called us that, if we'll take up that ministry and engage in it, the same thing is going to happen to the kingdom of Satan in our time that we see happening to Goliath in that time. Let's read on quickly. Man, the clock's even further away here. See, I can't even tell what time it is. I just got to keep going until someone stops me. Verse 27, he's just got done saying, what will happen and what is this uncircumcised Philistine? They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. Now, Eliab, one of them who is not doing something, is now going to become critical of the one who wants to do something. Now, look out for this. Soon as you step out on faith, soon as you step out on what God's called you to do, soon as you say, I fear God more than I fear man, someone's going to say, well, you know, I know your evil motive. You do? You know my heart. The only way, listen, this one's dangerous. The only way you can judge my heart, because you don't know my heart, it may be good, it may be bad. You don't know my motivation, but you don't know it. You got ideas. You can only judge my heart according to, guess what? The heart you're familiar with. And whose heart are you familiar with? Your own heart. And when you start reading things into my mind, I know what he's thinking. Oh, you do? When you tell me what I'm thinking, now I know what you're thinking. Kind of dangerous. Don't play that game. I know what you're thinking. Really? Because what you're saying, if I was in your position, this is what I would be thinking. With which, if it's noble, that's great. But if it's corrupt, it's kind of like, oops, you should have said that. When Eliab, David's older brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger. Why? Because his cowardness is coming to the surface. His lack of faith is coming up. It's revealing his inadequacy as a man of God in the military of Israel. He became angry. He says, watch this. Why have you come down here? What are you doing here, David? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? Well, I bet you, aren't you supposed to be watching, what, you got 10, 12 sheep? Who'd you leave those with? And he's trying to, hey, wait, guys, don't take him serious. He's just a shepherd of a small flock of sheep out here in the desert somewhere. No, the guys, no. Who, where's those sheep? He's trying to bring them down to the level of man. You're just a man. You're just a shepherd. Where's those little sheep? Notice he doesn't say sheep. He calls them few sheep. Those few sheep. You don't have a big flock. You don't even have a large group of sheep to watch over. We can't even trust you with more than 10 or 15 sheep. What are you going to do here, David? What are you doing? Watch. I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. No, man, my gosh, he's revealing all kinds of things. I know you're conceited. I know you're wicked. I know why you're here. You just came for a front row seat to watch the battle. Oh, yeah, like we've got a good battle, like this is worth coming to watch? What are you saying, Eliab? But notice he says these things. He calls him irresponsible. He calls him incompetent, arrogant, wicked, and self-seeking. But watch David's response. He says, now what have I done? Can't I even speak? He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter. You understand? He did not stop and engage in the ridiculous conversation and try to justify himself to somebody. He doesn't even care what they think. Eliab, now what have I done? I don't even care what you're talking about. And turned away from him. Gauge someone that was interesting him in what was going on. He turned his. That's the end of Eliab. He tried to make an attack. Now listen, one of the problems that don't want to make right here is we start trying to defend ourselves because we've got something to prove and we've got something to lose. David's got nothing to prove. He's got nothing to lose. What's wrong with you? What were you saying about winning the battle? You get tax free? You get the king's daughter? And this is an easy battle. I'll do this. When David said, what David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. Notice how fast a man speaking faith rises to the top. I mean, not necessarily in popularity, but in rumor. You see, there's someone doing something weird down there. They're believing in God. Really? And boom, it's at the top of the conversation charts. It's at the top of the rumors. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul. Verse 32, David said to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go fight him. Hey, I don't want you guys starting to get afraid here. Now, you've got David, who's supposed to be protected by the military, telling the military, you don't need to be afraid. I'll take care of it. Completely out of his league, but not really. Verse 33, Saul replied, you are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a boy. And the word boy means youth or a young youth. And he has been a fighting man from his youth. He started fighting battles when he was your age. How can you fight him? Now, isn't that funny right there? He's been fighting since he was your age. Well, then who was he fighting? Other youths? He had to start fighting somewhere. So meaning right there, you've got to start. You can't fight this battle. You can't fight this giant because he's old and experienced. He's been fighting battles since he was your age. Well, eventually, David's going to be the Goliath. Eventually, they're going to say, David's been fighting battles since he was a youth. But anyway, Saul's discouraging him. But David said to Saul, one of the great verses in the Old Testament, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. Now, this is why whatever God has got you assigned to do is so important. It's where you gain your confidence. It's where you learn to follow God. It's where you learn how God interacts with your world. He knows right here. When I was watching my father's sheep, when a lion or a bear came out and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. Now, just think if David wanted to be king someday. Here comes the lion to attack the sheep. Man, I want to be king someday. If I chase that lion, he might kill me, and I won't get to be king. I'll just let that one go. You understand that's dangerous. You see the defeatist in that? Here comes a bear. I don't know. Better protect myself because I've got something very important to do for God someday. It don't get any more important than right now, this moment. If you can't handle the bear and the lion right now, you're not headed for being the king. You've got to kill the bear. You've got to kill the lion. Whatever is there right now, that's what you've got to do. One, because it's the right thing to do. Two, it's practice. How are you going to trust God in the big picture and fight the big giant if you ran when you saw a lion or bear? Now, did David kill the very first lion he saw? It doesn't say. I don't know. I would think that David probably threw a couple stones somewhere in his life and missed. You know, it's like, why? Because he's human. He's got to learn. Everything we do, we're practicing. We're getting better. God's using him where we're fit. And he had him fit, was practicing, and was using him against the lion and the bear to protect the sheep. He said, I went after it, I struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. Man, I mean, it wasn't just like a lion walking around the woods, say, boo, get out of here. I mean, he'd already attacked the sheep, had a sheep, was running off the sheep. David went and rescued the sheep before it got killed. When it turned on me, it dropped the sheep and turned on David. Oh, good time to run. He says, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. So you understand, this is not killing bears and lions just with sling stones. This is hand-to-hand, face-to-face combat with a lion. I grabbed it by its hair. That's pretty close, you see. He's pretty close to the lion. And struck it. Kapoosh! You know, yeah, get out of here, lion. Or whatever, hit it with a club or something. Well, that's hand-to-hand combat with a beast. David, he said, I'll do the same thing to Goliath. I got to go hand-to-hand with this guy. He's going to throw a stone at him, but you know, I'll kill him somewhere if I go hand-to-hand. Your servant has killed both lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So Saul said to David, go, go. And the Lord be with you. Good luck, son. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. Now, I don't know what's going on here. A couple of things. Maybe Saul all of a sudden has a particular interest in preserving David. Maybe he looks at David and says, man, you don't have any equipment. I'll get let you. Or maybe this might win. I better get my uniform. So he's getting all, he's maybe load him up with his own stuff. Maybe he's got more confidence in his own military dress than he does in anything else. Maybe he thinks there's good luck. Maybe there's, you know, some things they thought that if you wore a certain man's clothes, you had his power. Well, anyway, he said, here, put my tunic, coat of armor, his bronze helmet was on his head. David fastened the sword over his tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to it. Well, let me try this out. Right here, what this is right here, this is all of a sudden, let me show you how to play man-to-man defense. I know we got a big game tomorrow. Have you ever heard of man-to-man defense? No, here, try it once. It ain't going to work. You can't just, you've got to be practicing. He has to be using this against the lion and the bear. This has to be David. Now listen, a good here, you have to be who you are. Don't copy somebody. Well, this is the steps. This is what you do. This is how you become successful. Who are you? You've got to practice against the lion and the bear. You've got to miss. You've got to hit him once. You've got to find out what works for you. God has equipped you. God has empowered you, but it's not always the same. David knew how he fought, how he'd be successful. And Saul said, here, try mine. It really works well for me. Doesn't have any scratches on it. He walked around. He wasn't used to it. And he says, I cannot go in these. Notice up in verse 32, he says, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight. I will go. Now with this stuff, he says, I can't go in this. Very important. If you're going to do what God's called you to do, you're going to have to go in the confidence of God. And once you start trusting in men's ability and men's weapons and power and all these things, you can't go. Don't go that way. Go in what God has equipped you with. That doesn't mean you're not going to use stuff like this. David's going to use a sword. He's going to use a shield eventually. But that's not where his confidence is at. He says, I cannot go in these because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. And the word for used, all those tried, used, and used again, right there in those two verses, is the word proved. I haven't proved this. God hasn't proved it to me. I haven't proved it to God. I don't know if this will work. I let God lead you through it. Goes on. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose five smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch on his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, he approached the Philistine. Now, he took five smooth stones, one of two options, probably more. One, in case he misses. I mean, he's planning for failure. Oh, Queen Miller, I might have missed. Some people say, and it's potential, that the legends and the stories about these people was that there was five of the giants, five of the descendants of Nephilim left. Goliath is one of them. We're going to read later on in 2 Samuel the other four. And David's mighty men are going to kill the other four. And it describes it for us. He might have been thinking, one stone's for Goliath, and the other four are for his four other brothers. I'm taking him all out because God wants the world rid of this and was going after him. That might have been the reason he took five, because it matches up with the giants that was left. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. There's no scars on this kid, man. The kid's not even shaven yet. Oh, this is embarrassing. And Goliath thinks Israel's mocking him. Just sending out a sacrifice. Here's a teenager. Kill him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Dagon is his god. Remember earlier in the book of 1 Samuel, Dagon, when the ark was brought in front of Dagon, what did Dagon do? Fell flat on his face in front of the ark. So he curses David by Dagon. We're just moments away from Goliath being the same position God was, face down. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. David shouted at the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, man's power, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. I'm not fighting you for Israel. I'm fighting you because you've defied God, and I'm coming back at you because of that. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I'll give the carcasses of the Philistines' army. We're not going to keep you as servants. I'm going to give your carcasses to the army of the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spirit that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet him. Goliath had no idea. Well, what's this? He's not running back. He's mouthing off. This is the first time they probably mouthed off back to Goliath. They came out with a little battle cheer. Goliath said, I'm going to kill all of you. I defy your army. They all ran away 80 times. Now he says his little battle cry, insults David. David hollers back longer, more. I mean, remember, David's a psalmist. You know, he's been writing psalms. He's been singing songs out there, and he knows how to put words together. And he's throwing lyrics right. That'd make a great song right there. He comes right back at him with that and then starts running at him. It's like, whoa, we got a battle. Hey, where's my sword? And here comes David charging at Goliath. For the first time in 40 days, you've got a shepherd boy attacking Goliath, just like he's a bear attacking the sheep. I love this part right here. David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. Now, you do want to look at your notes here very quickly, because I've got just a few things for you just to look at here. Beginning on page 2. First, the stones could be 2 to 3 inches big. I've got three pictures right there. You've got a tennis ball in that third picture, and you've got some stone. Those are actually stone. Those are sling stones that have been dug out of the ground. They find them all over. Especially, there's a part right there, and that first paragraph underneath the guy throwing the stone there, 10 miles north of Jerusalem, up in the area of the tribe of Benjamin, they found just tremendous amounts of these stones, because even in the book of Judges, chapter 20, it says the tribe of Benjamin was trained. They had groups of like 700 men that were trained to sling a stone with their right hand and with their left hand, and they could hit a hair on a man's head. In other words, they became so precise with this, they could not only just hit someone in the head, they could hit parts of their face with these sling stones. There's a picture of a man throwing a sling stone right there, and from what we always think it's like over the head, could be. But some people say in the military they train them to throw underhand right there like a softball throw. They get like a 3-foot strip of leather with a stone in it, size of a golf ball up to the size of a baseball. And they even said the Greeks, Romans would train them in different parts of their military, would have different size of balls that they would be throwing at people. They would carve or bust them out of stones, they'd actually make those round like that. They wouldn't actually pick them up. By the time the Romans got there, they're making them out of clay and actually designing different weights and different things. You know, Romans had to always take everything to another level. And they'd throw these things underhand, potentially, and they would go, as you read on through here, you can see right here, where does it say right here? Turn the page. It says they'd wind up like a softball pitcher. On that next page 4, I think it is. Yeah, right there it is, the second paragraph. It says, surprisingly, a good slinger hurled a stone as far and accurately as a good archer. Roman military text recommended archery target practice at 200 yards. That's their practicing. Roman practice was 200 yards. Man, I'd try to throw it across this room. But 200 yards, see, that's a pretty useful weapon. They're 2 football fields away, and we're hitting targets. Slingers are known to hurl their projectiles even further, as much as 440 yards or a quarter of a mile. Came out at about 60 miles per hour. Also, the fourth paragraph, the bottom line, it says, oh, no, the last one, it would, unarmored bodies were easily penetrated by sling stones that we're going to see right here in the story. It punctured his head. It sank into his forehead, Goliath. An ancient medical book included instructions for removing lead and stone sling missiles from bodies of wounded soldiers. I mean, they come back to battle lines with stones in their body that they had to have removed from the battle scene. So David is using not just a child slingshot, but he's using something that they used throughout the military. Romans, Greeks, the Maccabees had great armies that would sling stones down upon the Greeks when they were attacking. Let's finish this up.
It says, so David ran towards him, verse 49, reaching into his bag and taking out a stone. Now remember, he just picked this one up off the creek. He wasn't planning on fighting the giant. He didn't come prepared. He came to do what his dad told him to. But there's one thing missing, and that is a spoil of war. So I'll get one right here. He takes his sling, runs at the guy, and sinks it into his forehead. Verse 50 says, so David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. Verse 51, David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword, drew it from its scabbard. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward. Now, here it is. Guess what? All of a sudden, Israel, they're brave. Israel all of a sudden, charge. Now they're cheering. One person, one boy comes up and does what God wants the army to do. And now all of the army all of a sudden knows what to do. Your impact on people and your family and your community, it's huge. They see you when you say something and you follow through with it and you do it in a godly way and you do God's plan. Guess what? People are going to follow. They're going to ridicule you. There's people, they're not going to do it. They're going to ridicule. But when it works, it's like, that's what we've been waiting for. It's natural. When you see what God is doing, it's going to bring other people on board. They all took off. It says, then the men of Judah, Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath. That's all the way back in the land of Philistia. And to the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the Sharim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. And he put the Philistine weapon in his own tent. We'll finish. But what happens right here, he cuts off the Philistine's head. Now, when he took it to Jerusalem, it's we don't know. But it says he took it up to Jerusalem. Some people think he would have carried it with him back to his tent. In fact, he's going to come back into the tent of Saul. And Saul says, David, where's David? Come here. Of course, Saul's still in the tent. He's got a hold of the head, and he's got the head, Philistine head. Right? Is this what you're afraid of? He brings it back to him. It's a mess. It's a mess right here. This is gory stories right here. This is what you're looking for? David kept that, and it says he took it to Jerusalem. Either he kept it with him, which is kind of strange, for the rest of, until he becomes king some 14 years later, or potentially, since Bethlehem was only 2 miles from Jerusalem, when he went home, the Jebusites still controlled Jerusalem, and no one could get into Jerusalem. So David is living in the land of Israel, in the promised land, 2 miles away. The Jebusites will not let the Israelites take their city. And David says, no, this isn't right. And what he did to Goliath, he probably potentially took that, put it outside the city wall on a stake or on the wall somewhere to let them know, hey, you remember this guy? It's going to happen to you too. And within a few years, within 15, 20 years, David is living in the city of Jerusalem, makes it the city of God. It was like he knew what he was going to do when he was king. He wasn't trying to become king. He knew God was going to lead him, but he took that hand and says, this is going to go all the way to the top. I'm taking this city when I become king. He knew where God was leading him. He had the confidence, not just that day to kill the bear and the lion, not just to kill Goliath, but to take the city of Jerusalem for God. He was looking beyond this war. He would say, yes, look what I've done. No, he was saying, this is the way we're going to continue to move. He wasn't just rejoicing in one victory for God. He was looking at a continual lifetime of victories as he continued to follow God. The same thing is true for us. Father, we come to you today in the name of Jesus. We ask that we may have confidence. We ask that we may look into your word and find the ways to live, to have the fear of God. Father, we thank you for the victories we've had in the past. Father, we ask that we would live in such a way that we're not trying to prove. We're not afraid to lose. But Father, we do fear you and fear not following your plan. Because, Father, in that we will find victory as you continue to lead us. Father, I ask that you empower these people, encourage them with your word and by your spirit and with each other's presence. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.